Blue Mars, Cassette 15. Terminator's tracks were numerous. Each smooth gray cylinder held several meters off the ground by an endless row of thick pylons. As the city slid majestically westward, it passed small stationary platforms leading to underground transfer bunkers, baked Ballardian space plane runways, and crater rim refuges. Leaving the city was a controlled activity, no surprise, but Miguel had a pass, and so the two of them activated the South City doors with it and stepped into the lock and across into an underground station called Hammersmith. There they suited up in bulky but flexible spacesuits and went out through a lock into a tunnel and up onto the blasted dust of Mercury. Nothing could have been more clean and spare than this waste of black and gray. In such a context, Miguel's drunken giggling bothered Zoe more than usual, and she turned down her helmet intercom until it was no more than a whisper. Walking east of the city was dangerous. Even standing still was dangerous. But to see the sun's edge, that's what they had to do. Zoe kicked at the rocks as they wandered southwest to get an angle on their view of the city. She wished she could fly over this black world. Presumably some kind of rocket backpack would do the trick, but no one had bothered to work it up as far as she knew. So they trudged along instead, keeping a sharp eye to the east. Very soon the sun would rise over that horizon. Above them now, in the ultra-thin neon-argon atmosphere, fine dust kicked up by electron bombardment turning to a faint white mist in the solar bombardment. Behind them, the very top of the dawn wall was a blaze of pure white, impossible to look at even through the heavy differential filtering of their helmet face masks. Then the rocky flat horizon ahead of them to the east, near Stravinsky Crater, turned into a silver nitrate image of itself. Zoe stared into the explosive phosphorescent dancing line, rapt. Sol's corona, like a forest fire in some silver forest just over the horizon. Zoe's spirit flashed likewise. She would have flown like Icarus into the sun if she could. She felt like a moth wanting the flame, a kind of spiritual, sexual hunger, and indeed she was crying out in just the same involuntary orgasmic cries, such a fire, such a beauty. The solar rapture, they called this back in the city, and well named. Miguel felt it as well. He was leaping from boulder tops eastward, arms spread wide, like Icarus trying to launch himself. Then he came down awkwardly in the dust, and Zoe could hear his cry even with her intercom volume turned almost off. She ran to him and saw the impossible angle of his left knee, cried out herself, and knelt at his side. Through the suit, the ground was frigid. She helped him up, his arm over her shoulder. She turned up the volume on her intercom, even though he was groaning loudly. "Shut up," she said. "Concentrate. Pay attention." They got into a rhythm, hopping west after the receding dawn wall, still incandescent across the top of its tall bell curve. It was receding from them. There was no time to be lost. But they kept falling. The third time, sprawled in the dust, the landscape a blinding mix of pure white and pure black, Miguel screamed in pain and then panted out, "Go on, Zoe, go, save yourself. No reason both of us should die out here." "Oh, fuck that," Zoe said, picking herself up. "Go! I won't. Shut up now. Let me try carrying you." He weighed about what he would on Mars, 70 kilos with the suit, she guessed, more a matter of balance than anything else. So while he babbled on hysterically, "Let me go, Zoe. Truth is beauty. Beauty, truth. That is all you know. And all you need to know." She leaned over and put her arms under his back and knees, which caused him to shriek. "Shut up," she cried. "Right now, this is the truth, and therefore beautiful." And she laughed as she started to run with him in her arms. He blocked her view of the ground directly before them, so she had to look forward in the blaze and black with sweat in her eyes. It was hard going, and twice more she fell, but while running she thumped along at a good speed back toward the city. Then she felt sunlight on her back. It was like the pricking of needles, even through her insulated suit. Massive surge of adrenaline, blinded by the light, some kind of valley aligned to the dawn, then back into the patchy zone of light-shot shadows, a crazy chiaroscuro, then slowly, back into the Terminator proper, everything shadowed and dim except for the fiery city wall, blazing far above. She was gasping hard for air, sweating heavily, hot from exertion now rather than sunlight. And yet still the sight of the incandescent arc at the top of the city was enough to make one into a Mithraist. Of course, even when the city was directly over them, there was no immediate way of getting back up into it. She had to run past it onto the next underground station. Complete focus on running for minute after minute. Lactic acid pain. And there it was, up ahead on the horizon, a door in a hill beside the tracks. Pound and pound over the smoothed regolith. Violent hammering on the door got the two of them let into the lock and inside, where they were arrested. But Zoe just laughed at the Spas Polizei and got her helmet off, and Miguel's, and kissed the sobbing Miguel repeatedly for his clumsiness. In his pain, he didn't notice. He was latched onto her as a drowning man to a lifesaver. She only succeeded in disengaging herself from his grasp by banging him gently on his hurt knee. She laughed out loud at his howl, feeling a rush pour through her. Such adrenaline, so beautiful, rarer by far than any sexual orgasm, thus more precious. So she kissed Miguel again and again, kisses that he didn't notice, and then she barged through the Spas Polizei, claiming diplomatic status and a need for haste. "Get him some drugs, you fools," she said. "A shuttle for Mars is leaving tonight. I have to go." "Thank you, Zoe," Miguel cried. "Thank you. You saved my life." "I saved my trip home," she said, and laughed at his expression. She returned to kiss him some more. "It's me should be thanking you. Such an opportunity. Thank you. Thank you. No, thank you. No, thank you." And even in his agony, he laughed. "I love you, Zoe. And I love you." But if she didn't hurry, she would miss her shuttle. The shuttle was a pulsed fusion rocket, and they would reach Earth the day after tomorrow, and in a decent gravity the whole time, except for during the somersault. All manner of things were changing because of this sudden shrinkage of the solar system. One small result was that Venus was no longer needed as a gravity handle for rocket travel, and so it was coincidence only that had Zoe's shuttle, the Nike of Samothrace, passing fairly near to the shaded planet. Zoe joined the rest of the passengers in the big skylight ballroom to look at it as they passed. The clouds of the planet's superheated atmosphere were dark. The planet appeared as a gray circle against the black of space. The terraforming of Venus was proceeding apace, the whole planet in the shade of a parasol, which was Mars's old Soleto with its mirrors repositioned so that they did just the opposite of what they had done in front of Mars. Rather than redirect light onto the planet, they reflected it all away. Venus rolled in darkness. This was the first step of a terraforming project that many people deemed mad. Venus had no water, a stupendously thick superheated carbon dioxide atmosphere, a day longer than its year, and surface temperatures that would melt lead and zinc. Not a promising set of initial conditions, it was true, but people had begun to try anyway, humanity's reach continuing to exceed its grasp, even as its grasp became godlike. Zoe thought it was wonderful. The people who had initiated the project were even claiming it could happen faster than the terraforming of Mars. This was because the complete removal of sunlight had profound effects. The temperature in the thick carbon dioxide atmosphere, 95 bar at the surface, had been dropping by 5K a year for the last half century. Soon the big rain would begin to fall, and in just a couple hundred years the carbon dioxide would all be on the planet, in dry ice glaciers covering the low parts of the surface. At that point the dry ice was to be covered by an insulating layer of diamond coating or foamed rock, and once sealed off, water oceans would be introduced. The water was going to come from somewhere else, as Venus's natural inventory would cover it to a depth of a centimeter or less. The Venusian terraformers, mystics of a new kind of Veriditas, were currently negotiating with the Saturnian League for the rights to the ice moon Enceladus, which they hoped to drive down into Venusian orbit and break up in successive passes through the atmosphere. This moon's water, once rained onto Venus, would create shallow oceans over about 70% of the planet, entirely covering the wrapped carbon dioxide glaciers. An atmosphere of oxygen and hydrogen would be left in place, some light would be let through the parasol, and at that point human settlements would become possible on the two high continents, Ishtar and Aphrodite. After that, they would have all the remaining problems of terraforming that Mars had been dealing with, and they would also have the very long-term, specifically Venusian projects, of removing the CO2 ice sheets from the planet somehow, and also imparting enough spin to the planet to give it a reasonable diurnal cycle. For the short term, days and nights could be established using the parasol as a giant circular Venusian blind, but in the long run, they didn't want to rely on something so fragile. With a quiver, she imagined it. Some centuries hence, a biosphere and civilization established on Venus. The two continents inhabited, the beautiful Diana Rift, a fair valley, billions of people and animals, and then one day the parasol knocked awry and a whole world roasted. Not a happy prospect. So now, even before the massive flooding and scouring of the big rain, they were trying to lay metallic windings as physicalized latitude lines around the planet, windings that would, when a fleet of solar-powered generators were placed in fluctuating orbits around the planet, make the planet, in effect, the armature of a giant electric motor, the magnetic forces of which would create the torque that would increase the planet's spin. The system's designers claimed that in about the same time it would take to freeze out the atmosphere and drop an ocean, the impetus of this Dyson motor could speed Venus's rotation enough to give the planet a week-long day. So there they would be, in perhaps 300 years, down on the transmogrified world, planting crops. The surface would be massively eroded, of course, and still very volcanic, with carbon dioxide trapped under the seas ready to burst out and poison them, and week-long days cooking and freezing them. But there they would be, nevertheless, everything stripped, raw, new. The plan was insane. It was beautiful. Zoe stared up through the ballroom ceiling at the gibbous gray globe hopping from foot to foot in her excitement, in her horror and admiration, hoping to catch a glimpse of the little dots of the new asteroid moons that were home to the terraforming mystics, or perhaps the coronal arc of a reflection from the annular mirror that used to be Mars's. No luck there. Only the gray disk of the shaded evening star, the signet of people who had taken on a task that recontextualized humanity as a kind of god bacteria, chewing away at worlds, dying to prepare the ground for later life, dwarfed most grandiosely in the cosmic scheme of things, in an almost Calvinistic masochistic heroism, a parodic travesty of the Mars Project, and yet just as magnificent. They were specks in this universe. Specks! But what ideas they had. People would do anything for the sake of an idea. Anything. Even visit Earth. Steaming, clotted, infectious, a human anthill stuck with a stick. The panic pullulation ongoing in the dreadful mash of history. The hypermalthusian nightmare at its worst. Hot, humid, and heavy. And yet still, or perhaps because of all that, a great place to visit. and Jackie wanted her to check in with a couple of people in India anyway. So Zoe had taken the Nike and would later catch a Mars shuttle from Earth. Before she went to India to talk to Jackie's contacts, however, she made her regular pilgrimage to Crete to see the ruins that here were still called Minoan, although in Dorsa Brevia she had been taught to call them Ariadnean. Minos had been the one to wreck the ancient matriarchy after all, and so it was one of the many travesties of Terran history that the destroyed civilization should now be named after the destroyer. But names could be changed. She wore a rented exoskeleton made for off-world visitors oppressed by the G. Gravity was destiny, as they said, and Earth had a lot of destiny. The suits were like bird suits without wings, conformable body suits that moved with one's muscles while providing some undersupport, body bras. They didn't entirely ease the effect of the planet's pull, for breathing was still an effort, and Zoe's limbs felt heavy within the suit, so to speak, pressed down uncomfortably against the fabric. She had gotten used to walking around in the suits on previous trips, and it was a fascinating exercise, like weightlifting, but not one that she liked very much. Better than the alternative, however. She had tried that, too, but it was a terrible distraction. It kept one from really seeing, really being there. So she walked around the ancient site of Gornia in the peculiar, somewhat submarine flow of the suit. Gornia was her favorite of all the Ariadnean ruins, and the only ordinary village of that civilization to have been found and excavated. The other sites were all palaces. This village had probably been a satellite of the palace at Malia. Now a warren of waist-high walls made of stacked stones covering a hilltop overlooking the Aegean. All the rooms were very small, often 1 meter by two, with alleys running between shared walls. Little labyrinths, yes, and very much like the whitewashed villages that still dotted the countryside. People said that Crete had been hard hit by the Great Flood, as the Ariadneans had been by theirs following the explosion of Thera, and it was true that all the pretty little fishing harbors were flooded to one extent or another, and the Ariadnean ruins at Zakros and Malia were entirely drowned. But what Zoe saw on Crete was an everlasting vitality. There was no other place on Earth she had seen that had handled the population surge as well. Everywhere, small whitewashed villages clung to the land like beehives covering hilltops, filling valleys, and surrounded by crops and orchards, with the dry, knobby hills still sticking out of the cultivated land in sculptured ridges rising to the central spine of the island. The island's population had risen to over 40 million, she had heard, and yet the island still looked much the same. There were just more villages built to match the pattern not only of the existing ones, but of the ancient ones like Gornia and Itanos as well. Town planning with a continuity 5,000 years old, continuity with that first peak of civilization, or final peak of prehistory, so tall as to be glimpsed even by classical Greece 1,000 years later, enduring by oral transmission alone as the myth of Atlantis. And then also in the shapes of all their subsequent lives, not only on Crete, but now on her Mars as well. Because of the names used in Dorsa Brevia and that culture's valorization of the Ariadnean matriarchy, the two places had developed a relationship. Many Martians came to Crete to visit the ancient sites, and there were new hotels near all of them now, built on a slightly larger scale to accommodate the tall young pilgrims visiting the holy places station to station. Phaistos, Gornia, Itanos, Malia, and Zakros under the water, even the ridiculous reconstruction at Knossos. They came and saw how it had all begun back in the morning of the world. Zoe, too, standing in the brilliant blue Aegean light, straddling a stone alleyway 5,000 years old, she felt pouring into her the reverberations of that greatness, up through the spongy red stones underfoot and into her own heart. Nobility that would never end. The rest of Earth, however, was Calcutta. Well, that wasn't really fair, but Calcutta itself was definitely Calcutta. Fetid humanity at its most compacted. Whenever she went out of her room, Zoe had at least 500 people in her field of vision, and often a few thousand. There was a frightful exhilaration in the sight of all this life in the streets, a world of dwarfs and midgets and other assorted small people, all of whom saw her and clumped like baby birds to a parent who could feed them, although Zoe had to admit that the clumping was friendlier than that, composed more of curiosity than hunger. Indeed, they seemed more interested in her exoskeleton than her, and they seemed happy enough, thin but not emaciated, even when they were clearly permanently camped on the streets. The streets themselves were co-ops now. People had tenure, swept them, regulated the millions of little markets, grew crops in every plaza, and slept among them, too. That was life on Earth in the late Holocene. After Ariadne, it had been downhill all the way. Zoe went up to Prahapur, an enclave in the hills to the north of the city. This was where one of Jackie's Terran spies lived, in the midst of a jammed dorm of harried civil servants, all living at their screens and sleeping under their desks. Jackie's contact was a translator-programmer, a woman who understood Mandarin, Urdu, Dravidian, and Vietnamese, as well as her Hindu and English. She also was important in an extensive eavesdropping network and could keep Jackie informed concerning some of the Indian-Chinese conversations about Mars. "Of course, they both will send more people to Mars," the heavyset woman said to Zoe after they were out in the compound's little herb garden. "That's a given, but it does look like both governments feel they have their populations in a long-term solution. No one expects to have more than one child anymore. It's not only the law, it's the tradition."
"The uterine law," Zoe said. The woman shrugged.
"Possibly so. A very strong tradition, in any case. People look around, they see the problem. They expect to get the longevity treatment, and they expect to have a sterility implant at that time. And in India, anyway, they feel lucky if they get the permits to remove the implants. And after having one child, people expect to be sterilized for good. Even the Hindu fundamentalists have changed on this. The social pressure on them was so great. And the Chinese have been doing this for centuries. The longevity treatment only reinforced what they had already been doing."
"So Mars has less to fear from them than Jackie thinks."
"Well, they still want to send up emigrants. That's part of the overall strategy. And resistance to the one-child rule has been stronger in some Catholic and Muslim countries, and several of those nations would like to colonize Mars as if it were empty. The threat shifts now from India and China to the Philippines, Brazil, Pakistan."
Zoe said. Talk of immigration always made her feel oppressed, threatened by lemmings. "What about the ex-metas?"
"The old Group of 11 is rebanding in support of the strongest of the old metanats. They will be looking for places to develop. They're much weaker than before the Flood, but they still have a lot of influence in America, Russia, Europe, South America. Tell Jackie to watch what Japan does in the next few months. She'll see what I mean."
They connected up wrist pads so that the woman could make a secure transfer of detailed information for Jackie.
"Okay," Zoe said. Suddenly she was tired, as if a heavy man had crawled into the exoskeleton with her and were dragging her down. Earth, what a drag. Some people said they liked the weight, as if they needed that pressure to be convinced of their own reality. Zoe wasn't like that. Earth was the very definition of exoticism, which was fine, but suddenly she longed to be home. She unplugged her wrist pad from the translators, imagining all the while that perfect middle way, that perfect test of will and flesh. The exquisite gravity of Mars. Then it was down the space elevator from Clark, a trip that took longer than the flight from Earth, and she was back in the world, the only real world, Mars the Magnificent.
"There's no place like home," Zoe said to the train station crowd in Sheffield, and then she sat happily in the trains as they flowed over the Peasts down Tharsis, then north to Ekis Overlook. The little town had grown since its early days as the terraforming headquarters, but not much. It was out of the way and built into the steep east wall of Ekis Chasma, so that there wasn't much of it to be seen. A bit on the plateau at the top of the cliff, a bit at the bottom, but with 3 vertical kilometers between the two, so that they weren't visible one from the other. More like 2 separate villages connected by a vertical subway. Indeed, if it weren't for the flyers, Ekis Overlook might have subsided into sleepy historic monument status, like Underhill or Senzeni Na, or the icy hideouts in the south. But the eastern wall of Ekis Chasma stood right in the path of the prevailing westerlies that came pouring down the Tharsis Bulge, causing them to shoot up in the most astonishingly powerful updrafts, which made it a birding paradise. Zoe was supposed to check in with Jackie and the Free Mars apparatchiks working for her, but before getting embroiled in all that, she wanted to fly. So she checked her old Santorini hawksuit out of storage at the glider port and went to the changing room and slipped into it, feeling the smooth, muscly texture of the suit's flexible exoskeleton. Then it was out the smooth path, trailing her tail feathers, and onto the diving board, a natural overhang that had been artificially extended with a concrete slab. She walked to the edge of this slab and looked down, 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 3,000 meters down to the umber floor of Ekis Chasma. With the usual burst of adrenaline, she tipped forward and fell off the cliff. Head first down, down, down. The wind picking up in a swift whoosh over her helmet as she reached terminal velocity, which she recognized by the pitch of the whooshing. And then she spread her arms and felt the suit stiffen and help her muscles to hold the beautiful wings wide, and with a loud crumping smush of wind, she curved up into the sun, turned her head, arched her back, pointed her toes, and set the tail feathers left, right, left. And the wind was pulling her up, up, up. Shift her feet and arms together, turn then in a tight gyre, see the cliff, then the chasm floor, around and around, flying. Zoe the hawk, wild and free. She was laughing happily, and tears streamed this way and that in her goggles, dashed away by the force of the G. The air above Ekis was nearly empty this morning. After riding the updraft, most flyers were peeling off to the north, soaring or shooting down one of the clefts in the cliff wall, where the updraft was diminished and it was possible to tip and dive in stoops of great velocity. Zoe, too, when she had gotten about 5,000 meters above Overlook and was breathing the pure oxygen of her helmet's enclosed air system, turned her head right and dipped her right wing and curved through the exhilaration of a run across the wind, feeling it keen over her body in a rapid, continuous fingering. No sound but the hard whoosh of wind in her wings. The somatic pressure of the wind all over her body was a subtly sensuous massage, and she felt it through the tightened suit as if the suit weren't there, as if she were naked and feeling the wind directly on her skin as she wished she could be. A good suit reinforced this impression, of course, and she had used this one for 3 M-years before leaving for Mercury. It fit like a glove. It was great to be back in it. She pulled up into a kite, then stunted forward in the maneuver called Jesus Falling. 1,000 meters down, and she pulled her wings in and began to dolphin kick to speed her stoop until the wind was keening loudly over her, and she passed the edge of the Great Wall going well over terminal velocity. Passing the rim was the sign to start pulling out, because as tall as the cliff was, at full stoop the chasm floor came rushing up like a final slap in the face, and it took a while to pull out of it, even given her strength and skill and nerve, and the reinforcement of the suit. So she arched her back and popped her wings and felt the strain in her pecs and biceps, a tremendous pressure even though the suit aided her with a logarithmically increasing percentage of the load. Tail feathers down, pike, 4 hard flaps, and then she was jinking across the chasm's sandy floor. She could have picked a mouse off it. She turned and got back in the updraft, gyred back up into developing high clouds. The wind was erratic today, and it was an all-absorbing pleasure to tumble and play in it. This was the meaning of life, the purpose of the universe, pure joy, the sense of self gone, the mind become no more than a mirror of the wind, exuberance. She flew like an angel, as they said. Sometimes one flew like a drone, sometimes one flew like a bird, and then on rare occasions one flew like an angel. It had been a long time. She came to herself and lofted back down the wall toward Overlook, feeling tired in her arms. Then she spotted a hawk. Like a lot of flyers, if there was a bird in sight, she tracked it, watching it more closely than birders had ever before watched a bird, imitating its every twitch and flutter to try to learn the genius of its flight. Sometimes hawks over this cliff would be innocently wheeling in the search for food, and a whole squadron of flyers would be above it following its moves, or trying to. It was fun. Now she shadowed the hawk, turning when it did, imitating the placement of the wings and tail. Its mastery of the air was like a talent that she craved but could never have, but she could try. Bright sun in the racing clouds, indigo sky, the wind against her body, the little weightless gut orgasms when she peeled over into a stoop, eternal moments of no mind, the best, cleanest use of human time. But the sun fell westward, and she got thirsty, and so she left the hawk to its day, and turned and coursed down in giant lazy S's to Overlook, to nail her landing with a flap and a step, right on the green Cocopelli, just as if she had never left. The neighborhood behind the launching complex was called Topside, and it was a mass of cheap dorms and restaurants, inhabited almost entirely by flyers and tourists come to watch the flying, all eating and drinking and roving and talking and dancing and looking for someone with whom to tandem the night. And there, no surprise, were her flyer friends, Rose and Imhotep and Ella and Esteban, all in a group at the Adler Hofbrau House, high already and delighted to see Zoe back again among them. They had a drink at the Adler to celebrate the reunion, and then went to Overlook, and sat on the rail catching up on gossip, passing around a big spliff laced with Pandorf, making ribald commentary on the passing parade below the railing, shouting at friends spotted in the crowd. Eventually they left Overlook, and went down into the crowds of Topside, and slowly made their way through the bars to one of the bathhouses. They piled into the changing room and took off their clothes and wandered naked through the dark, warm, watery rooms, the water waist-deep, ankle-deep, chest-deep, hot, cold, lukewarm, splitting up, finding each other later, having sex with scarcely visible strangers, Zoe working slowly through several partners in her own orgasm, purring happily as her body clamped down on itself and her mind went away. Sex. Sex. There was nothing like sex except for flying, which it much resembled. The rapture of the body, yet another echo of the Big Bang, that first orgasm. Joy at the sight of the stars in the skylight overhead, at the feel of warm water and of some boy who came in her and stayed in her, nearly hard, and 3 minutes later stiffened and started humping again, laughing at the approach of another bright orgasm. After that, she sloshed into the comparative brightness of the bar and found the others there, Esteban declaring that the night's third orgasm was usually the best, with an exquisitely long approach to climax, and yet still a good bit of semen left to ejaculate. After that, it's still fine, but more of an effort. You have to be wild to get off, and then it isn't like the third anyway. Zoe and Rose and the rest of the women agreed that in this, as in so many other ways, being female was superior. In a night at the baths, they routinely had several wonderful orgasms, and even these were as nothing compared to the status orgasmus, a kind of running, continuous orgasm that could last half an hour if one were lucky and one's partner skillful. There was a craft to this that they studied assiduously, but it was still more art than science, as they all agreed. One had to be high, but not too high, with a group, but not a crowd. Lately, they had gotten pretty reliably good at it, they told Zoe, and happily, Zoe demanded proof. Come on, I want to be tabled. Esteban hooted and led her and the rest down to a room with a big table sticking out of the water. Imhotep lay on his back on the table, Zoe's mattress man for the session. She was lifted up by the others, lying on her back as well, and slid down onto him, and then the whole group was on her, hands and mouths and genitals, a tongue in each ear, in her mouth, contact everywhere. After a while, it was all an undifferentiated mass of erotic sensation, total sex around, Zoe purring loudly. Then, when she started to come, arching up off Imhotep with the violence of the cramping, they all kept going, more subtly now, teasing her, not letting her land, and then she was off and flying. The touch of a little finger would keep her going until she cried out, "No, I can't!" And they laughed and said, "You can!" and kept her going until her stomach muscles truly cramped, and she rolled violently off Imhotep and was caught by Rose and Esteban. She couldn't even stand. Someone said they had her off for 20 minutes. It had felt like 2, or eternity. All her abdominal muscles ached, as did her thighs and butt. "Cold bath," she said, and crawled off to the cool water in a nearby room. But after being tabled, there was little else at the baths that could appeal. Any more orgasms would hurt. She helped to table Esteban and Xerxes, and then a thin woman she didn't know, all fun, but then she got bored. Flesh, flesh, flesh. Sometimes after being tabled, one got further and further into it. Other times, it became just skin and hair and flesh, insides and outsides. Who cared? She went to the changing room and dressed, went outside. It was morning. The sun bright over the bare plains of Luni. She flowed through the empty streets to her hostel, feeling relaxed and clean and sleepy. A big breakfast, fall into bed, delicious sleep. But there in the hostel restaurant was Jackie.
"If it isn't our Zoya!"
She had always hated the name, which Zoe had chosen for herself. Zoe, surprised, said, "Did you follow me here?" Jackie looked disgusted.
"It's my co-op, too, you might recall. Why didn't you check in when you got back?"
"I wanted to fly."
"That's no excuse."
"I didn't mean it as one."
Zoe went to the buffet table, piled a plate with scrambled eggs and muffins. She returned to Jackie's table, kissed her mother on the top of the head.
"You're looking good."
Actually, she looked younger than Zoe, who was often sunburned and therefore wrinkled, younger but somehow preserved, as if she were a twin sister of Zoe's, who had been bottled for a time and only recently decanted. She wouldn't tell Zoe how often she had had the gerontological treatments, but Rachel had said that she was always trying new variants which were coming out at the rate of 2 or 3 a year, and that she got the basic package every 3 years at the most. So although she was somewhere in her 5th M decade, she looked almost like Zoe's contemporary, except for that preserved quality, which wasn't so much body as spirit. A look in the eye, a certain hardening, a tightness, a wariness or weariness. It was hard work being the alpha female year after year, a heroic struggle. It had worn visible tracks in her no matter how baby smooth her skin, no matter how much a beauty she remained. And she was still quite a beauty, no doubt about it. But she was getting old. Soon her young men would unwrap themselves from around her little fingers and drop away. Meanwhile, she still had a great deal of presence,
and at the moment she appeared considerably put out. People averted their eyes as if her look might strike them dead, which made Zoe laugh. Not the politest way to greet one's beloved mother, but what else could one do? Zoe was too relaxed to be irritated. Probably a mistake to laugh at her, however. She stared coldly until Zoe straightened up. "Tell me what happened on Mercury." Zoe shrugged.
"I told you. They still think they have the sun to give to the outer solar system, and it's gone to their heads. I suppose their sunlight would still be useful out there. Energy's always useful, but the outer satellites should be able to generate what they need now. So the Mercurians are left with metals."
"That's right.
But what do they want for them?"
"Everyone wants to be free. None of these new little worlds are big enough to be self-sufficient, so they have to have something to trade if they want to stay free. Mercury has sunlight and metals, the asteroids have metals, the outer satellites have volatiles, if anything. So they package and trade what they have and try to make alliances to avoid domination by Earth or Mars."
"It isn't domination."
"Of course not."
Zoe kept a straight face.
"But the big worlds, you know, are big."
Jackie nodded.
"But add all these little ones together, and they're big, too."
"Who's going to add them?" Zoe asked. Jackie ignored the question. The answer was obvious anyway. Jackie would. Jackie was locked into a long-term battle with various forces on Earth for what came down to the control of Mars. She was trying to keep them from being inundated by the immense home world, and as human civilization continued to spread throughout the solar system, Jackie considered the new little settlements pawns in this great struggle. And indeed, if there were enough of them, they might make a difference.
"There's not much reason to worry about Mercury," Zoe reassured her.
"It's a dead end, a provincial little town run by a cult. No one can settle very many people there, no one. So even if we do manage to bring them on board, they won't matter much."
This ends side one of cassette 15. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.